and welcome to the Roundtable Podcast. At this point, we are recording outdoors in the beautiful California weather in San Diego at the World Fantasy Convention, so pardon any background noise you might hear. Today we are podcasting with Nalo Hopkinson. Nalo, if you can say hello.
Hi.
And Karen Ward.
Hi.
So how have you guys been enjoying the convention so far?
Well, I arrived last night, so it's sort of hard to tell. I'm still at the stage of you walk 2 feet and meet someone you haven't seen in a year, and then 20 minutes later, three more people join you. So far I'm having a great time. I haven't been to any events, any panels, nothing.
Well, I got in the day before, evening. I similarly haven't been to any panels, but I know they're very, the people that I tend to know are people I've seen from ICFA. So there's still quite a lot of people that I haven't met yet. And I'm just taking it in completely.
I have to remember that.
Try not to sleep too much. Just getting in as many different meetings and conversations. And the conversations, of course, are brilliant.
Yeah. What was the thing we were talking about, ended up talking about yesterday, is all the alternate meanings of teabagging?
Oh, France. Oh. Stop her! Stop her! There's no good coming of this one.
No, there is. Well, it's to the point where it's only, what day is today? Friday? And already, if you walk into a group of people and say teabag, they'll fall out laughing. Which is as it should be.
Oh, dear.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. I encountered this in-joke. You know, they make it an in-joke. Hours, she's just arrived in hours and already there's an in-joke. So I sit down and they sit in a lot of tea bags and then they just start laughing, like almost to the point of tears laughing. And I'm just here at this. Did I miss something?
Yeah.
And then, of course, they had to explain it to me, which was worse. So yeah.
And being as it's a fantasy convention, everyone's got, you know, Google on speed dial, so yeah. Or looking it up.
That's actually another cool thing. You look at the breakfast table, or you look at, you know, people just even somebody's walking about, and we've got this extra appendage thing going on, you know. I've seen so many touches and phones and iPads and fantastic.
Oh, at this point, the one thing that would be most likely to reduce me to an absolute hysterical wreck would be if I lost my phone.
Yeah.
Listen, don't go there. I haven't even contemplated that. I actually walk around with all my technology because it needs to be close
that.
To me.
Right. Well, and last night, I got up for my share of the late night feedings. I couldn't find my phone in the dark, and it wasn't where I'd left it. And I was like, no, what am I going to read while I'm feeding the baby? And so I picked up my husband's phone, who's playing with this Wikipedia app, and then in the morning I was like, honey, have you seen my phone? He goes, oh, I put it on the charger.
Oh,
I'm
yes.
Like, oh, well,
that would have made
you.
Sense. Yeah. Never occurred to me that the phone could be a breastfeeding app.
Yeah, I could see that.
Oh, no, if you go into, like, pregnancy or parenting and just search on the apps, oh my god.
Yeah.
I don't use any of the tracking ones.
But damn it, it's
where
a fantasy convention.
If you want to measure every burp of your child and every spit bubble, there are apps for that.
Oh,
that's actually really cool.
I do have one baby app. It's a Baby Geek, and I'm not using it to track, like, feedings and diaper changes, but I am using it to track developmental milestones.
Excellent.
By the way, I just want to tell all of our listeners that young Gadget is absolutely adorable.
Yeah, he's about, what, a foot and a half? Of cute,
that.
Concentrated cute.
Utter cute.
Oh.
We're talking gravitational field,
yes.
Sort of.
Just,
you know, even those of us who, you know, I'm the kind of the tough person who's like, yeah, you know, kids take him or leave him, right?
Right.
Whatever.
Right.
Yeah, you got a kid fine over there. And then I see this one, I'm like, oh, but you're special. Sorry. So, right, back to our regular
right,
program.
Yes, actually, back to you know, to
he's
topics.
even here, and he's like, we're all baby all the time.
But, okay, so one of the things we were thinking about talking about was folklore.
Yes.
You guys have
right.
both used elements of folklore in your fiction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, Karen, did you have an idea of where you wanted to start with this?
I do have an idea. Especially since it's we were talking about your abstract for ICFA, and I had a thought for a paper for ICFA, which is not going to happen now because I have no time whatsoever.
Right.
When I read Skinfolk,
mm-hmm.
which was the first and so far, unfortunately, the only work of yours I have read, but the one that completely, I was like, yes, she's telling our stories. And do you know about Skinfolk?
The one I've read is New Moon's Arms, so I haven't read Skinfolk.
Okay.
If you read Skinfolk, my reaction to it was, I don't know what the heck North American readers get out of this, but they could never be getting as much out of it as I do, because I know all the background stories.
As a Caribbean reader, yeah.
As a Caribbean reader, you know all the myths and the legends behind it. So I was actually thinking about a paper that talked about myth as meaning making, but particularly the horrors in our life, trying to make meaning of them.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking of two things in particular. There's Rolling Calf,
mm-hmm.
and the variation, which is a Barbados steel donkey.
Mm-hmm.
I know, we're going to have to explain these things to you.
Rolling Calf is a puka. It comes straight from British mythology.
Okay.
But it got over the water and kind of got Caribbeanized, so...
But here's the interesting thing. Do you know a bit more about steel donkey?
I know more about the Trinidadian version, which is the Lagahu.
Okay, okay.
But which is a were-donkey...
Mm-hmm.
would wear in washikongs, which is running shoes, tennis mm-hmm. shoes, and he has a waistcoat with a fob watch and gold teeth, and he's supposed to be terrifying. Maybe you just laugh yourself.
Well, tennis shoes and terrifying don't
tend to
be. We're frightened of very specific things.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
so tell me about steel donkey.
Steel donkey is basically a donkey that's jointed. It's made of metal, and they would hear this like rattling
yes,
going through the neighborhood.
It's the death chains of the puka. It's the same idea with the watch.
The rolling calf. I always imagine rolling calf has eyes of flame.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and but the thing is that ties into, especially for us. Ours was a complete plantation society. So if you can imagine the time when they started making sugar and it was a lot more machinery, you know, full industrial age, there were some severe dangers of, like, losing a limb amid the machinery.
People falling into the vats of boiling sugar. That
exactly.
was a horrible, horrible death.
So the heat and the fire and the clanking of the metal then kind of coalesces into this steel donkey rolling
mm-hmm.
calf image of it's a night terror, basically. You know, you've been working all day in this
mm-hmm.
factory, and you're imagining this factory in donkey form coming down the village road looking for you in your sleep.
Yeah.
So, holy shit.
Yeah.
Yes.
And Rolling Calf, which is the Jamaican version, changes shape. One of its shapes is a small kitten. It looks...
Oh.
harmless, but it still has those yellow eyes,
yeah.
and its favorite food is molasses. Everything ties back. I mean, molasses being the raw form of sugar, so everything ties back
mm-hmm.
to that you know, horrible, horrible experience that was being forced to work in sugar plantations.
Mm-hmm.
And molasses being, on one hand, the sweet that as a slave you could give your kids, and on the other hand, it's this. It comes out of your labor. It comes out of
your
out
sweat.
Of your death. It comes out of yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Very much so. The thing about using Caribbean folklore is that a lot of people from the Caribbean don't know it. Just
mm-hmm.
like you know, talk about folklore here, and most people might be able to tell you about Cinderella, and that would be it.
Yeah.
So I can assume when I'm writing that nobody knows what I'm talking about except other writers.
Uh-huh.
And it was like, you know, reading your first novel and. Just so much of it invoking simultaneously the Caribbean and then you know, the science fiction stuff that was just kind of hitting the right notes, and then Amos Tutuola, who I grew up reading, and that feeling of something sort of pan-African
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and simultaneously quite old and quite new
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
was just part of the delight for me of reading it and,
mm-hmm.
and the humor. That every so often you'd kind of break that fourth wall a little and talk to the audience, and I so got it.
You know where that's from.
Mm-mm.
Paul Keynes Douglas.
Of course.
Say that a little louder.
Paul Keynes Douglas. Not all of influences are written on the page. A lot of the influences are oral. And Paul Keynes Douglas is, I guess, the way you could describe him as a storyteller.
Mm-hmm.
But imagine somebody who's almost like a stand-up comic. But he's telling a story, and it's a funny story. And he'll be telling you a story, for example, about like this old woman who goes to watch cricket with a pink parasol, mm-hmm. and she's reacting to a very close finish. And it's a very ordinary scenario, and the way he tells it, you're falling about laughing.
Yeah.
And for generations afterwards, you're going to have West Indians saying, and there's the pink parasol, up and down, up and down. And all you have to say is that, and people just start laughing because it's that...
You're saying that noise. No.
I can edit that out.
Rolling calf. You can hear it coming.
You're going to have some nightmares tonight, aren't you?
And here's before my nightmares are mostly post-apocalyptic landscapes. Now you guys are just adding.
Yes, with mechanical donkeys. I put a rolling calf in the novel I'm going to read from today.
Ooh.
Yeah, so much fun to write a rolling calf.
Well, yeah.
Put her in 21st century Toronto.
yeah. So he's done some very like lighthearted things, but there was this particular one that he did called Jumbies, Duppies, and Spirits. And well, a Jumbie, I kind of stole the name a bit from my book, but a Jumbie is basically a spirit or a ghost as well, and a Duppie is definitely specifically a ghost.
Mm-hmm.
And he just tells you all the folk legends. So when you said they won't know, I think that for most of my generation, if you ever heard Paul Keane's Douglas,
mm-hmm.
with that particular story or performance, Jumbies, Duppies, and Spirits, you knew all about Rolling Calf and Dwen and Laja Bless and all the rest of them and exactly what they're supposed to do just from listening to
mm-hmm.
him.
But it's a clear generational difference because I was just back at University of the West Indies in Trinidad. The St. Augustine campus for the 30th annual West Indian Literature Conference. So I was meeting students,
mm-hmm.
and there's a clear divide of generations between what we know of our culture and what they know. I mean,
right.
they're just as culturally connected as we are, but the cultures change.
Yes.
So
yes.
they don't necessarily have connections to the stories that were mostly oral,
mm-hmm.
or that you read in books.
Mm-hmm.
It was theirs is very much like. It is here at internet connected.
Internet.
They know about the music. They know about the dance. They know about they know
mm-hmm.
who's Trinidadian on what's that show that's about making clothing. She says
Project Runway. Yeah.
Project Runway.
Yeah. There's some woman who's doing very well and she's Trinidadian.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all looking
yes.
for her. She was a runner up for Miss World or something.
I have no television.
I have no idea. I have no television.
Yes.
But yeah, something like that. She was a contestant for Miss World or Miss Universe, and partly learned to sew a few months ago, and suddenly was brilliant
yes,
at it, and
yes.
is on Project Runway and doing quite
yes.
well.
So they know that kind of connection, but the older stories they won't necessarily know as
mm-hmm.
well,
unless they had a grandmother.
So. Mm-hmm. It was interesting hearing writers like Merle Hodge talking about teaching creative writing and her students trying to set things in the U.S.
Oh, man.
Trying to set things in places that... It's not that the places don't exist, it's that it is no place. Because, I mean, we're used to writing about places that don't exist, but they're not inventing a culture. They're making it deliberately sort of unidentifiable because they're not seeing...
Mm-hmm.
Caribbean stuff in the main
mm-hmm,
literature.
Mm-hmm.
They get it in school
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
sometimes, but so they don't think, they think that authenticity is American.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they read work like yours and mine, a lot of the time it's the first time they're seeing, between the pages of a book that you can buy in a bookstore rather than be taught at school. They're seeing Caribbean folklore.
I'm beginning to realize, I've been doing some research work and I've been traveling a bit in some of the Eastern Caribbean. And one of the things that struck me is how different culture can be even from island to island.
Oh, yeah.
Because I'm listening to what you say about what you discovered in Trinidad.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm remembering at home, there are two things that stood out for me. Yes, you do have a kind of a, shall we say, Facebook generation
mm-hmm.
who are writing things that are kind of generic.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember there's also this young man whose name I forget, and I could be saying his name on podcasts right now. But
and
who's
now
I
we
forget?
Need to I'll say that you're from Barbados, I'm from Jamaica.
Right. Absolutely. They're not next to each other. Okay, it's quite a plane ride. I've never been to Jamaica. Okay, just want to make that clear. Right. So moving on. And he wrote the short story, which was published in PUI, which is the English Literature Department at University of West Indies Cape Hill campus. That's their literary journal. And I was at the launch of PUI, and I heard him read it. And unfortunately, I've forgotten the name of the darn thing, but he took one of the folklore nasties.
Yeah.
Baku. It was Baku. A Baku.
Yes.
Man.
From Guyana.
How could I forget? Because I use the Baku.
Yes.
The Baku is like a little malevolent spirit in whatever in a bottle. Okay? So the story is really creepy because it's completely contemporary, and then it's got this sort of old style thing in it. And it's this girl, kind of like, you know, young teenager, whose mother has a boyfriend, and the boyfriend is starting to make advances on her. And her mother won't listen to her. Her mother's like dismissing it. It's your classic setup for domestic violence coming along, sexual abuse coming along. So she goes, she hears some advice from somebody. She goes to this old woman in the market and says, "I hear that you can help me get rid of all my problems." And the woman hands her a bottle and basically says, "You know, you put it there and you open it and you step into the closet and you close the door and don't open the doors until it eats up all of your problems." So there's this bit right where the guy, you know, he's starting to come onto her again, and she actually like leaves the bottle and she closes the door and she hears it come out of the bottle and eat him.
Oh.
And then this is the bit that really got me. Her mother comes home. And she said, and she's there in the closet, she's thinking, yes, and the woman said, "Don't come out, don't open the doors until all of my problems are eaten up." And he just ends there, and I'm like, oh my gosh. So that was an absolutely chilling example of how beautifully you can just like bring that kind of old folklore and the modern thing together.
Mm-hmm.
And the way he described it as well, it was mainly like a tongue that came out of the bottle. Sorry.
And then it was Tananarive Diu through whom I found out that Baku is a West African word.
Really?
Because she uses a Baku in what's called The Good House, her novel The Good House. And she's done the research, it's very clearly a West African borrow.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very similar to malevolent spirit. What I love in Guyanese folklore is the way in which the Baku gets tied into the plantation owner. Baku is in some ways in Guyana is a poltergeist as well. And I remember reading stories as a kid that were about Baku and Mynheer. Mynheer being, of course, Dutch for master.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
And Mynheer always meant the white male plantation owner who was turned into this monster of a creature. Which of course makes perfect sense. So this stuff is always, I mean, folklore in general, because I use Caribbean folklore, I use the British folklore I learned as a kid, I use, you know, it's so rich because it takes the knowledge and experience of centuries and just condenses it into these very, very powerful stories that we sort of respond to.
These images, really.
Yeah.
I do want to point out, by the way, that I quite knowingly did not portray the Baku accurately in my book.
Mm-hmm.
It's the what I portrayed in my book is actually more of a skin stealer.
Yes.
Okay.
There is an aspect of the Baku which is a poltergeisty aspect, which is there, but the bottle is always the key part.
Yes.
And I've often thought to myself that maybe even alcoholism as well is a part of the mythos of the Baku, the idea of this thirsty spirit.
Gave me an idea, which I hope I will remember by the end of this podcast.
Quick, give her a notebook.
No, I think I got it.
Okay. See the conversation. Yes. Mm, yeah. So when you talk about it like that, that's what I wanted paper to be about. I wanted to take some of these symbols, some of these well-known names, and talk about, trace it back to the history, and say, this is why there would have been that fear and this fear and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, this one might be upsetting, but Dwen.
Oh. Well, see, I've never found the Dwen upsetting because it's like they have their own power.
No, the concept... Okay, I'll tell you what I know as Dwen, because sometimes there's slight variations in the items as well. Dwen is a spirit of a miscarried child.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's why I was warning you.
Thank you.
And So basically you would look out and you see a chow, what looks like a perfectly ordinary chow, like in the forest somewhere, just looking at you. But its feet are on backwards.
Do they wear Panama hats in your version?
Dwen is not so much a Bajan thing. What I know of Dwen is only from, I think, more Guyana. So I've always looked at that and I'm like, you know what that is like? It's almost like you think that they are going to come towards you, but they're actually, the feet, the way the feet are pointing, they're always going away from you. So there's that very poignant kind of, you know.
Yes.
Reaching for a child that's never going to be coming towards you.
Well, and the other thing that just sparks for me is the breech births.
Backwards.
With the feet.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes. And that inversion of what's supposed to be.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. In Trinidad, Duens sort of you will again be in the bush, and you'll hear them. They're playing. They're laughing and playing.
Mm-hmm.
And Duens in Trinidad wear big Panama hats, so it's not just that their feet are backwards, but you'd never see their faces because they haven't fully achieved, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But you follow the voices. And they lead you, and you follow the footsteps.
Mm-hmm.
And you think they're leading you out to the bush, and they're actually leading you in deeper. And that sort of simultaneously playful and powerful, scary aspect of the baby. I always kind of liked doing
it.
So clearly had a life of their own on that other side. And they're the ones with the power when you get into the bush, which is where the spirits live, right? Mm-hmm. They're the ones with the power. And what's funny to me about so much Caribbean folklore is that you never figure out, you never are told what the bad ending is. The horror is that this creature exists. So even La Jablesse, if anybody knows any French, it's the female devil. You go back to the plantation, she's very, very beautiful. She's wearing a madras head wrap in the style that an African slave woman would have worn it, and she's probably wearing it and tied in a way that signals that she's, you know, single and available.
Mm-hmm.
And she's wearing
a long dress,
and she's very flirty. Mm-hmm. And if you are a man who's been out drinking late at night and you're wandering
traveling a long road
alone
in the dark,
yes,
and there is this lady who's just, you know, looking for someone to escort her back, you know?
Yes. And she leads you on. And if you're not too drunk, you might start to hear how her feet sound, because you'll hear one footfall and then a clonk. Footfall and then a clonk. And she's got a goat hoof, which is, of course, the sort of, that goes right back to Greek mythology
And diabolical.
Yes, and then sometimes she has pointy teeth.
Yeah, yeah.
But you never hear the ending of the story. It's like,
you don't.
Oh, it's a La Jablesse. Everybody goes, ah, and you're done, right?
But I've always found that tale is in the same way you like Dwen. I kind of almost have a liking for the La Jablesse story because, look, it's an inversion. If you're a woman on a lonely road and a man is coming, you're the one who's scared of what he's going to do. So this is a complete inversion of the tale, where it's like, yes, you think that you have, you know, easy prey or whatever, or maybe you are a poor innocent man who's trying to be
she's
a gentleman.
Trying to get home.
And she's the one who is going to dispose of you, you know?
Yeah.
So
I end up using, I put a La Jablesse in, I wrote just published a story, my first novelette, in the new Bordertown anthology.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome to Bordertown, and people who are paying attention will find the La Jablesse in there.
Do you know another one from your skin port that I really was stuck with me? Old Heeg.
Ah, Old Heeg. That's
Bracer again.
Well, it's another you said night terror.
Mm-hmm.
Old Heeg is the night terror personified. In Nova Scotia, they say the hag is riding you when that happens. It's
okay.
Sleep paralysis.
Mm-hmm.
Is that phenomenon when your brain's awake but not the part of it that will let you move.
Yes.
And you tend to hallucinate that there's something threatening you.
Right. In a lot of a lot of people link that to, for American modern, I would call it folk tales, UFO abductions.
Ah,
yes, exactly.
It does have that same phenomenon,
very
same, translated nowadays.
Very same
nowadays.
Feel. And what you hallucinate sometimes is that this scary woman is actually sitting on your chest menacing you.
Mm-hmm.
Old Heeg, and Heeg is hag. sometimes called Sukuyan, is an old woman who can, yeah, this is why I need to warn you, more baby stuff.
Yes.
She feeds on the blood of babies, and she takes her, skin off at night and turns into a ball of fire, and she can get through keyholes that way. And the interesting thing, the way you catch an old hag is you find her skin, because she has to put it aside, and you fill it with salt or pepper. So when she tries to put it back on and it starts burning her, she calls out. And the other way you catch her, which is very much a vampire thing, is you sprinkle rice grains across the doorway, and she's compelled to stop and count the grains. And if the sun comes up while she's still counting and she doesn't have her skin on, she burns up. You ever heard them too do olaig? There is a performance troupe from Guyana called them too, those two. And they do a poem by R. Wordsworth McArdle, who's a Guyanese poet, that is about the old hag and about a man who's trying to save his child and who knows it's an old hag that's been preying on the child. And he sprinkles the rice and waits for her. And as she's trying to count the grains, he's got a cudgel and he's beating her. And the verse is, waxen, waxen, fly, fly, die, oh, would you die? And them two act out the thing as they. But it's something you'll find in vampire lore, is that obsession with numbers and counting.
Yes.
And having to get the counting right.
I was thinking for some reason of Cupid and Psyche, because wasn't there one of her tasks as well where she had to
that one I
pick
don't
up grain or
so well, but it does
but
show
it's,
up
it's,
a lot.
It does show up a lot.
Yeah.
Well, I know Peter Watts in Blindsight, he has this theory of vampirism. And again, it's basically like an extreme form of OCD.
Yes. He and I talked about that while he was working on Blindsight, and I was working on, I forget what, but I was doing a fantasy version of a vampire, and he was doing that version. But we had the same OCD, we'd come up with different reasons for the why a cross was a problem.
That
sort of ended up at the same place. And I remember him being fascinated that he had this whole scientific reasoning and I had this fantastical reasoning.
Yeah, that was the same.
Yeah, the same result.
And they all got to OCD one way or another. I don't remember where I was going with that. Where was I going with that?
This is the way we roll.
Yes.
And it all comes together beautifully. You were telling me about Dem too. You were telling us about the performance
about
of that.
Hike.
No, I was just saying that when you wrote it, it really struck me. And because again, it's just one of those things where it's an explanation again for, like, you know, sudden infant death syndrome, for one thing.
Yes, very much so. And for night terrors.
So you're always taking your individual and your societal, fears and
things,
phobias.
You can't explain that they're just take things away from you. Yeah.
And you give it a body. You give it a body and you give it a name and you say, "Hey, Zach." And to do that, we need to sprinkle rice, or, you know, open up the Bible to a certain psalm, or and you have something to do that focuses your mind into dealing with it in some way.
Yeah, the danger with old hag is that you end up. I've read theories that it was a way of. Often, because women tend to live longer, they might be the ones who are able to accumulate any kind of wealth in a small village.
Get rid of the old women.
Yes. So you have that old woman who has all that stuff. You know, and she you don't like her anyway because she's
an old woman.
Yeah, so she becomes a threat.
Yes,
exactly. So you become suspicious of her, and of course you can get a whole village attacking one poor old woman because you've decided she's preying on your young, right?
Yeah.
And of course the babies need to be defended. So
you can justify so much in me. Think of the children.
Think of the children. So there's so many ways you can turn it. And writing from the perspective of the old hag was interesting to do. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, discovering the Adze. I was reading. You do a lot of research, and I was reading a book that had been written about Guyanese Maroon populations in the late 19th century. Mm-hmm. Maroons were Africans who ran away from slavery and went into the bush and reformed their own communities. Mm-hmm. And in a couple of cases were able to get independent rule. Mm-hmm. In Jamaica they did, led by a woman. And in the border between Guyana and Suriname they did. And an anthropologist and his wife went into that community to do research to white people. These folks had a written language. They had, and it's in the back of the book. I know. But a lot of their tales had also been written down, and one was about the Adze. Mm-hmm. And I read the description, and it was the Sukuya, it was the old hag, except they were a whole race. So there were men, women, children.
Okay. So this was another vampiric kind of...
Vampires, uh-huh. Yeah. And they lived... I think they lived in the community, and because they look like humans, you don't necessarily know that they're... And I thought, huh. But what is this Adze? And I looked it up, and it's, again, a West African name mm-hmm. for something that's very much like a vampire. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it never occurred to me, growing up with old hag, that it would be a whole
group of people.
That it would be a creatures that they would be, yeah. So they would be breeding, right?
Yes.
Oh. So I now have a project that's been growing slowly for a while because it wants to be a comic, and I don't do comics, and I'm working with my partner on it.
You don't do comics?
I mean, I want to do comics.
Okay, good. I was wondering, do I have to break down her resistance?
No, not in the least. That was a wistful don't do,
okay.
Not a...
Okay, excellent.
I'm working on it. I'm working on it hard. And this one wants to be a comic, but it wants to be about the development of corporations.
That is the true purpose of speculative fiction, to say something about the contemporary world, the world that you're in as well.
Yes,
in a fantastical
yes,
way.
Yes, yes. And between me and David, we have this amazing idea, and the execution is going to take us a very, very long time. So don't hold your breath.
But I'm still going to be remembering it and looking forward to it. But what you said just now, you know, the about corporations and so on, there is another sort of Paul Keynes, Douglas-esque mm-hmm. kind of thing. We have some performances at home called like Pamplam and Dumplings in the Stew and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You've ever been to them?
No.
Okay.
I know the word Pamplam, but...
Okay. These are like almost like annual things. And sometimes they're sketches and sometimes they are poems. But the poems are stories in themselves. Or you would have something that's not rhyming. It's almost like a monologue. And the one I remember was very much like Jumbies, Duppies, and Spirits.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about this old woman and I guess her young granddaughter, whoever wanted to go out, and it was nighttime. And she was like, "You want to go out?" And she just starts telling her these scary things until the girl stays in because she's so terrified. But the one that stuck in my memory, the two final ones, was... you know, she's talking about at so-and-so's rum shop, there was this empty sardine tin that started to dance at the place across the way where they cut a dollar bill and it began to bleed. And I'm like,
yeah.
A bleeding dollar bill.
Yeah.
There's just something about that.
Yeah,
that's
coming
so...
coming from, yeah, our cultures and our histories. And of course, the dollar bill comes with blood.
Oh, my word. Yeah. So you get these urban legends. Now, what kind of urban legends do you mm-hmm. have? Because... that was the other thing. In addition to this young man who was writing about Baku,
mm-hmm.
there are a lot of people in my country right now who are all like, "I'm going to write about the Heart Man."
Black Heart Man.
Okay, wait a minute. What do you know of this?
Well, you go first because you started and people listening are going, "What did she say?"
When I was in primary school, there was a serial killer about. And
most people don't. Be quite so happy.
Don't know that I did a little happy dance.
Yes, when people say serial killer.
Well, I kind of understand why she's the happy dance, but sometimes when you have like a really traumatic, something like that, these really traumatic murders, it does take on the status of myth.
Oh, absolutely.
Because it has to be explained. So you have this funny situation when you're in primary school where adults don't want to scare you, but they kind of want to warn you. So sometimes you get this funny, filtered, odd thing where they're just telling you enough for you to be on guard, but not like too terrified. So the thing about the Heart Man is that he would kill you, he would take your heart out, and he drove around in a hearse. So whenever you saw a hearse, you would always be... And in a way, it's a good warning for a kid not to be too close to any kind of closed-up vehicle where they could be snatched, you know. Mm-hmm. But there's this thing about the hearse and the fact that he's, like, you know, taking your heart out. And there are so many people who are like, yeah, I'm going to write a book that's about the Heart Man. I'm going to make a film and it's going to be about the Heart Man. I'm like...
I already wrote that novel.
Well, the thing is, the sequel to Redemption, Indigo, is... partly
sorry, we just sorry, high-fived,
that was a high-five, yeah. Yeah. It's partly coming out of that, not directly. I mean, there's no hearse, there's, you know, I didn't want to be so direct with it when so many other people are trying to be.
Mine's not direct either.
There,
sorry.
You go. But the idea of this stalking person who is almost killing you in this ritual way and taking, you know, this like key poor part of you for goodness knows what nefarious purpose, what mm-hmm. arcane ritual supposed to be used for, that kind of concept, you know. And like I said, this is when I was in primary school, and I think it's one of our unsolved murders.
I wondered where, it's clearly an unsolved murder from somewhere, because mm-hmm. it's very clearly a serial killer story, because you have it in Jamaica, mm-hmm. but it's Blackheart Man.
Okay.
And it's very, very similar. It's a man, I don't remember the hearse part, but again, it's children, and he's taking their hearts out and eating them.
Mm.
And what fascinates me about Blackheart Man is that it's Old English, Blackheart,
yeah.
is Blackheart, right? And where's the story coming from? What's the root tale? Clearly something fairly modern, because
mm-hmm,
it's not an old story.
Mm-hmm.
Something happened somewhere in one of the islands, and the
yes.
story has spread in
yes.
this version,
yes.
and it was clearly... terrifying.
It was.
And
terrifying.
I want to know what the root story is. I have 90% finished a alternate history fantasy of the Caribbean,
mm-hmm.
set probably around 18th century.
Okay.
That's called Blackheart Man.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm playing with the idea that you can use myth like to demonize a whole group of people.
Yes, yes.
And in my story, the people who get called Blackhearts are the ones who work the pitch.
Oh.
They work their labors in the pitch lake.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this whole story that sprung up about how horrible they are, as people will, you know, tell tales about anybody who's marginalized.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And because they're working pitch, they wear... leather jackets to protect themselves,
mm-hmm.
and to get the pitch off their hands, they will sometimes rub.
Right.
Their hands. So you get the left side tends to have of the
right.
jacket tends to have this black mark,
uh-huh.
and they're the ones who get told horrible stories about. It's 90% done. It was actually under contract, but I was writing it at a time when I was very, very ill with anemia,
mm.
and did not know I was sick and couldn't finish anything, and so my publisher waited 4 years and finally had to cancel a contract.
Yeah, yeah.
The book is that close to done.
Ooh.
So it will get finished.
Yes.
And more props to my editor for, you know, holding off the dogs for 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
She held it off as long as she could and waited
yeah,
for me.
Yeah.
So I'm not at all mad at her.
I'm looking forward to seeing
but
that.
But there's... when you look into the histories... I mean, there was a serial killer in Jamaica.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, the story is not the same, so I don't think he's the Blackheart Man, but he was a wealthy man. Him and his family
mm-hmm.
had a big house out in the country, and they would waylay strangers and torture them and kill them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, so...
Well, there's a hint in
yes.
that legend as well, in our urban legend as well, that whoever did it, that the reason they weren't caught is because they were actually somebody fairly rich or well-connected.
Yes. Well, what happened literally with this guy was he only finally got caught when he shot a white man. He
mm-hmm.
shot a white policeman who was
mm-hmm.
trying to find him
mm-hmm.
because his servants had been complaining for years about what these people were doing, and they gave testimony in court, mm-hmm. testimonies on record, but because they were black and servants, mm-hmm. it couldn't be credited.
Right.
So he nearly got off. His one mistake was that he actually tried to kill a cop and didn't kill him.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the kind of thing that happens all the time, right? And some of the urban stuff is... I just really want to know what the actual stories are.
You kind of want to know, you kind of don't want to know. I want a generation to pass so I can be sure the person's dead.
Right.
Very, very
true. You know,
true.
Unsolved mystery is kind of like, yeah, maybe they're just like, you know, in a retirement home somewhere thinking, yes, I was young.
One thing I found is it's so much easier to be objective about things that happened before you were born.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And then when things happen after you're born, it's a lot more personal.
It's a lot more personal,
yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And how it enters the folklore is is fascinating to me too. And I mean, you're very generous in your you know, the parents only tell you part of the story because they don't want to scare you. I think they only tell you part of the story because they want to scare you. Because then you're, uh-huh. you just have this free-floating fear mm-hmm. of hearses or mm-hmm. of, you know, and you don't know what, you just know that it's so deep.
Mm-hmm.
You're just going to avoid. There are people from the Caribbean who will not read my work.
Really?
Because they're afraid that it's a deep fear that gets instilled in you as a child, that mm-hmm. reading this stuff will make it
happen.
Manifest.
It'll make
right?
it real.
Perfectly, otherwise perfectly rational people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But the fear has been buried at such a deep level.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's West Indian, one of the ways that you control your children.
True.
And coming out of a history where it was vital that you control your mm-hmm. children, because they would be sold away.
Yeah, yeah. if you didn't manage to keep them under control,
yes.
so they knew what rules to follow.
Yes.
But the funny thing about it is that it's not only your parents who tell you this, it's also older children
yeah.
who are happy to tell you
very
this.
Very happy to
yes.
pass on the misery.
And pass on what fragments they know.
Yes.
Talking about the
game telephone. Yes, yes, so to watch it change. There is a beautiful, beautiful, again, I use it in my Border Town story. Beautiful, beautiful song. It's a ring game that children play in Trinidad called In a Fine Castle.
Do you hear my Cecile?
In a fine castle. Do you hear my Cecile?
Yeah.
Y'all play it too?
Yeah, man.
Ours
is a pretty nice.
Yes, exactly. The whole story.
We want one of you.
Yes, the whole story in Welcome to Border Town is based on that.
Mm-mm.
On that game. And I know there have been readers who've complained it is not a Border Town story, and I suspect it's because it's not, you know, white fairies. but the game is two groups of children in rings, and one sings, you know, we're in a fine castle,
mm-hmm.
the other sings, but ours is the prettiest,
mm-hmm.
we want one of them, sings the first one, and they exchange mm-hmm. people back and forth. Well, the castle is the castle, what was the name of the castle in that the slaves were taken to and sent to?
Do you mean the one in Ghana?
The one in Ghana.
It's some museum now.
Uh-huh.
I don't remember the name offhand, but I know the one you're referring to.
Yeah.
It's sort of a fort.
Yeah, the fort. The fort was, it was called a castle.
Mm-hmm.
The fort that...
oh my goodness, it's a selling song.
Yes, exactly.
I've just got chills. Give me a minute. Okay, let me give you the lyrics. Okay, so we want one of you. Which one do you want? We want, call a name. What will you give for her? And then you offer things.
We'll give her a wedding ring.
A beautiful wedding ring, a beautiful boyfriend, a beautiful whatever. And then they go over. Now, you said two rings. I actually remember two lines. So you said, you know, skipping forward, skipping back, skipping forward, skipping back. And then you kind of switch back and forth until more people are over one time and they're like only two left.
Yeah.
And so it's a middle passage thing again,
isn't
it? It's
a middle passage thing is my feeling about it, because the place, the on the route, the middle passage route, where, you know, they'd march these people they had taken in slavery in
mm-hmm.
coffles to the fort at the edge of the ocean,
mm-hmm.
and it was called a castle.
Mm-hmm.
Goree is the name of it.
Yeah, I think you're right, yeah.
And then they would, from there, get on the ships and start this horrible, horrible journey where they didn't know where they were going,
mm-hmm.
where they thought white people were going to eat them when they got to the other end, where it was, in fact, much worse than that.
Mm-hmm.
And this very playful game is about, you know, giving away your people,
yeah,
selling
yeah.
them for stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And children are playing it, and it's like, yeah. And it's a lovely game when you're playing it, because you're going to get this cool thing, you know, that they're going to give you if you go with them.
But isn't that always the way? I mean, you have your other children still, which are like, you know, the plague or London is burning.
Or,
you know, here comes a chopper to chop off your head.
I love children for that, because they'll take... It's a way of triumphing over the horror.
Yeah.
They make it into a game so they can play it, they can win, they can, you know, laugh at it. It just... I love children. Just the sheer inventiveness.
Oh, but there's you gave me some serious children.
I'm sorry.
It was only when you started to get, that was the fourth, I'm like, oh, shoot.
Yeah.
And it all just sort of clicked into place. Because when you're a kid,
right,
you play things where you're like, if we stop and think about this, what does this mean? We have no idea what we're saying.
Yes.
None whatsoever.
Yes.
It's just a nice little tune to sing, and you get to skip about a bit, and your friend comes over to you and you get to hold her hand, you skip some more, and what are you saying?
You're saying something very, very powerful. You're reenacting bits of history. There's a beautiful Haitian folk tale. It's about three little girls who are friends, and one of them, I think her parents have given her up to the devil. And she knows the devil is going to come to collect her at a particular day and time. And, of course, she's terrified. And she tells her two friends. And her friends say, well, we can't let that happen. How's the devil going to know it's you? And she says, he knows my name. So they wait for the devil. They know when the devil's coming. The three of them wait. And the devil manifests up out of the earth, you know, in brimstone. And he says, where is Tepanji? That's her name. I'm not sure if I'm saying it right. Not Haitian, but... And one of the girls says, I'm Tepanji. And the second one says, I'm Tepanji. And the third one says, I'm Tepanji too. And he can't take her because he doesn't know which one she is. And the devil has to play by the rules.
That is the cutest Spartacus story I've ever heard.
Itty-bitty little Spartacus story.
And just the idea of three little girls outwitting the devil just by being so fierce in their love for each other.
Yes.
That they're willing to take the risk that he's going to take all three of them. But they know he has to play by the rules.
But isn't that the fascinating thing? All of these horrors we've described, there are rules attached.
Yeah.
And by knowing the rules that are attached, you can always get out of the situation.
Yes.
And that's what gives you that sense of control. So even while you're allowing yourself to be terrified, there's still this sense of, well, I know once I don't approach a crossroads at midnight, I'm perfectly fine.
Yes, right. Yes.
Well, I've read academic stuff to talk about the rules of fairy tales and folklore.
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes I've been reading fantasy stories and, you know, the child or the protagonist be told, now don't do this. When you go to the place, you know, there's something silly that you must not do.
Yes.
And of course, half the time they do it. And you're like, haven't you read a fairy tale? Good Lord, child. When the crazy old guy says don't do something,
don't
do it.
But see, that's the parent thing again, where the parent's not going to tell you why.
Right. You never know why you can't eat the food.
Yeah, yeah. And it's classic...
It's pure obedience.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The classic idiot plot you'll see in a lot of fantasy, you know, when people start writing it, because you don't give the information that the person would need to know in order to save their own ass. And why don't you tell them? Because you want them to get into a whole mess of trouble.
Because otherwise it wouldn't be a story.
Exactly.
Yep. Yep.
But the rules are fascinating. Why am I thinking of the rolling calf again and the rules it has to follow?
I think it pretty much has to stay on the road, doesn't it?
It has to stay on the road. There are things you can do or say to dispel that scary thing. And often it's so minor. But it has to listen. Like the rice with the old hag. You find that in folklore just the world over. Is that, you know, if you could just find the right key.
Well, and we were talking earlier about myth and imposing a narrative so that you can feel at least some measure of control.
Of control, yeah. And what happens?
Or as Karen put it, someone to blame.
No, you said that blame, assigning blame is a human trait. I agree.
Yes.
Basic
as
eating.
Yes, so much.
Yes.
So much. I like the tales that kind of break break the tradition somewhere or another. There's a British Isles folk tale about, and the, often it's the person who, it's the wise fool.
Yes. And the holy fool.
The holy fool, mm. Nasruddin, the country bookie.
Yes. He,
this is a guy who comes from the country to the big city, mm-hmm. and he goes to a pub, and people want to, they want to get one over on the simpleton from the city, mm-hmm. from the country, and they tell him about a haunted house, and all these horrible things that will happen to him if he goes there, and he'll be terrified. And he says he won't. Mm-hmm. I think there's some reward at the end of it if he stays the night in the house, so he goes. And the things that show up are truly terrifying. I mean, demons come out of the chimney, things come rolling across the floor that have just are just heads with nothing else. Just, and he's so unflappable.
Yes.
He's talking to them, he's being polite to them, he's making jokes with them. And he passes the night, and the guys from the pub come the next morning expecting to find him mm-hmm. dead of fright. Mm-hmm. And he isn't until one of them says something really, really simple. I don't even remember what it is. It's so inconsequential mm-hmm. about one of the things. And that's when he shudders. And that's the end of the story. He just goes, yeah! Because he's finally... he's finally... You know, it's just something really, really small. And
oh
that's
my
what...
goodness.
It's a story that has no point mm-hmm. whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Except that... the guy from the country is not as simple as you think.
Right.
because he is actually innocent.
Yes.
This
is a special type of... The type of innocence is not... it's not really folly. It's not really stupidity.
No.
It's almost a different way of viewing the world.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's more open to things that are strange, so he doesn't... But there's just not one little thing. Yeah.
It reminded me of two things. I think there's a Brothers Grimm story about the boy who wanted to shiver.
That's it.
And basically, he ended up marrying a princess because he faced all these horrors and he was, as you said, unflappable.
Yeah.
And so he wanted a prince hand. But he kept on saying, if only I could shiver. And she got so annoyed that she got some cold water from the river with lots of little fishes and poured it on him when he was sleeping. And he was like, okay, now I know
what it is like. Yes.
But when you were talking about the house... In the same volume that had the story that I used for Redemption and Indigo, there was a folk tale from China, which I absolutely adore because it was the same kind of thing. Here is this mansion, this amazing, opulent mansion, which has been haunted by the most, you know, incredible collection of creatures and ghosts and whatever you can imagine. Everybody's terrified of it. And this man, he's dared to go and spend the night there, or maybe he kind of stumbles over there because it's the only place of shelter. One of the two. And he's unflappable. So they try to scare him or whatever, and he gets to know them. And then they end up partying, and the guys are going to look him up, and they're like, we thought you'd find you dead of fright. No, just, you know, they're a bit loud, but hey, you know, want to come join the party?
Yeah, and then one of them says, but that's a blah, blah, blah. And he goes, yeah. Yeah.
Well, that bit didn't even come. He was just like, yeah. So and then he opens the door and they see what's going on. They're like screaming, going down the hill, you know, running. And he's still like, oh, well, you know, I'm going to go have a drink. You know, and he's cool.
Yeah.
So
the stuff that says, you know, the people that you disrespect,
mm-hmm.
you might think
cool,
again.
Yeah.
And where I saw aspects of that was when I first saw Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
Ah.
The scene where one of the many fight scenes.
There's so many.
But the bratty princess beats up a bunch of working class men.
In the drinking house.
Yes,
in the...
and they go and they complain that she doesn't have any manners.
Uh-huh.
And they're doing so in very kind of... the language is working class language.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But they're dead right. She doesn't have any manners. And but that had just been striking me about, you know, this,
yes.
I'm supposed to think she's a heroine. She's a brat.
She is. She
and
was.
To have these,
I never, yeah.
These farmers basically say the same thing, is that she's got no manners.
Mm-hmm,
she's not
mm-hmm.
playing right. She's not due. She's not being fair. And I loved them.
Yeah. Like, man, you nailed
they
it.
They were so insulted that she was just not...
She did not understand society's rules.
No. She was not playing fair. She was just rude. Yes, she is. She is just rude. She wants what she wants. She doesn't care about anybody else.
But I remember, it's the attitude of the protagonist sometimes that makes all the difference in the story. I remember I was reading Lovecraft shed over Innsmouth.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a guy comes to a town and it's very creepy, and the big reveal where he goes, oh my god, is like the people, they were fish people,
as they
were kind of taking over parts of the town, and they had a cult and a temple.
Mm-hmm.
And
in other words, they were Jewish. Lovecraft had his issues.
Lovecraft had massive issues.
His wife was part Jewish, and he would go on about this stuff, and his wife would go, that, that, you need to stop.
But the thing is, if you're a science fiction reader, you're just like, oh, well, those are aliens. Why don't you go talk to them?
Yes, exactly.
Find out more about them. This one could be really interesting. But instead, the guy's like, oh, my God, they're fish people. And he hightails it out of town as if the whole hounds of hell were after him.
Yes.
And I'm like, well, why didn't you just say hi?
Say hi.
You know?
They might have had really cool food.
Right, or something, you know, interesting to
He did not grow up on Sesame Street. Sesame Street teaches us to talk to monsters.
I think how Lovecraft have been different if he just...
Yes, I know. I one of the fun things about having won the World Fantasy Award is that I have a bust of H.P. Lovecraft in my home, which I'm sure makes him roll in his grave.
Oh, okay.
He was such a racist.
Oh,
he was. Yeah. His friends would be like, "Oh, H.P., please."
Well, and I mean, other ones of his stories, just like the whole point of the horror, the thing, the big reveal is miscegenation, and you're like,
"Yeah, no,
wow, really?" Yeah. This is like what I'm supposed to be afraid of.
A couple of people had sex and had a baby.
Oh my god, the horror. Yeah.
They're going to assimilate us. Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
They probably have better food.
Oh boy.
Now you've got me thinking about urban stories, because I know there are more in the Caribbean, and I'm blanking because you've...
Oh, I've got a couple. Now, I've been interested in that. People have looked at the protagonist for redemption and said that it's very fascinating how she dealt with her husband.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like kind of a direct confrontation, but a kind of a slow wearing down.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I heard two stories recently that I've been dying to share. And I do believe they're based in fact, okay? So, you know, but take it with a grain of salt, as it were. Both of them concern men who discover that their wives were unfaithful. But instead of the kind of the obvious reaction, which might be, you know, walk out or beat up the woman or whatever, in the first case, the man would just sit down with a Collins. Collins is like a cutlass. And he would just sharpen it every night, sitting on the edge of the bed, and sharpen it and sharpen it and sharpen it. And just put it under the bed and go to sleep. And then the next night, he's sharpening it. And finally, his wife just left, because she was like, she did not know at what point, at what night that might be used on her.
He didn't say
a word. He didn't threaten her. He just sat and he sharpened this thing. So that was the first one. And then the second one was in a way more direct, because the man goes out, he actually sees his wife with another man standing there in front of him. So he looks at the man and he says, put your hand in your pocket, you know, pull it out. So the fellow's got some jeans, says, give me the change. He says, okay, you can go along now. And then we ain't done yet. And then the days after that, when he sits down at table with his wife to eat, he takes those same coins and he puts them down the table and has his meal. And every meal he does that until she just can't take it anymore and she leaves.
That is a boof, my God. Lord of mercy.
The psychology of that.
Oh.
Isn't that just, you know?
Oh, my God. Not easy.
You don't raise your hand. You don't raise your voice.
No.
But let me tell you the result.
Oh, my. That's masterful. Mm-hmm. Even, as, yeah, so much of it I don't agree with. That's masterful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think a lot of the urban tales come out of things like rapso, calypso, what they call in Barbados. What is a Barbados spoken word? What am I thinking of?
What are you thinking of?
It'll come to me after the lovely Death Star microphone has been put away. Y'all need to see this thing. It looks like it has its own propulsion system.
It probably does. It
shoots lasers.
What it has is a really awesome onboard pre-processing system.
See, there you go. I knew there was a brain in there.
Oh my word.
But yeah, in
call it rhythm poetry.
Yeah, and modern music from the Caribbean is where you'll hear all those stories. And that's where I'd look for them. And I'm still not thinking of specifics because the ones I tend to remember tend to be more countrified.
Okay.
There's a... Oh, I'm going to forget the Calypsonian. It might have been Kitch. It might have been Lord Kitchener. My foot stick in a bamboo root. I fall down inside a chute. It's a man walking through a graveyard at night.
Mm-hmm.
And he trips, falls down inside the root of a bamboo, and all the spirits buried in the graveyard are in there. And it's a story of him trying to run, get up and run, and he keeps tripping and falling.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a lot of fun and scary at the same time, but it also harkens way back. He just had the wrong tree. It's the silk cotton tree that the spirits live in the roots of, because the silk cotton tree has buttress roots. And right through the Caribbean, parts of West Africa, and parts of, I forget where else, you will find that idea that the ancestors live
in
the roots of the silk, or the branches of the silk cotton tree.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, the Calypsonian might not have known the whole tale, but enough of it to get the sense.
He knew enough to know why that was so evocative.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And in some cases, it's a scary thing because they're ghosts. But in older cases, it's where you go for advice.
This is it.
They're
going to talk to you.
They're
your ancestors.
They're going to help you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And how it flips as, I guess, culture changes and the idea of what a ghost is changes.
Yeah.
Well, I know my brother and sister-in-law up in Maine, she's from Japan and he's from Maine, and they're raising their little boy in Maine. And my brother was like, so when he asks me about ghosts, I'm really conflicted because on his mom's side, ancestors are helpful.
Yes.
They're friendly. They're there to help. They're there to give advice.
Mm-hmm.
And on, you know, the New England side, they're, you know, oh, booga booga scary.
Yeah.
So we're really kind of navigating that.
Yeah. Well, you know,
It is both. I'm going to break down and tell you a family ghost story.
All right.
This is my mother's father. Now, I should point out, my generation spread out because my mother had me late. So if you can imagine it, my mother was born in 1929. She died some years ago, but she was born in 1929. And of course, her mother, her father would then have actually probably been born in the late 1800s or whatever. So we're talking a fair stretch.
Mm-hmm.
But it was about her father, who, you know, liked his drink on occasion, but had, I guess, it got to the stage where people felt he was maybe taking things a little too far. So there was one night when he was trundling on home in a particular state, but he realized that when he stopped to speak to people he knew, they just sort of looked at him and they were like, you know, rushing off. And he was like, why is everybody being so unfriendly? What's going on? So then when he sobered up the next day and he saw some of his friends, he was like, why did you behave like that? And as he asked a couple of people, he was told, there was a man and a woman following you, and if you could have seen the looks on their faces. And when they described it, they described his parents, who were dead. Walking along behind him after a drunken spree, looking ready to, you know, give him some chastisement.
Do not mess with Caribbean parents. Just do not mess.
You know, so you know, you hear that and you're kind of like, wow, yes, they're helpful, but man, you don't want to get on their bad side.
No, because their idea of help might be more than you're ready for.
Yeah.
That's brilliant. That reminds me of a story from Patron of Islands. This is an autobiography. I think it was probably written in the 30s by a white Englishman who was sent as a diplomat to the Pacific Islands.
Oh, okay.
And he was telling about his experiences there, and some of them were downright eldritch. And one of them involved meeting a one of the people he knew, one of the locals on the road, and talking about it the next day and terrifying people because the man had died the week before.
This sounds perfectly normal to me. Yes.
Or they decided at one point that he was too skinny, mm-hmm. and so they were going to fatten him up, so they're going to have a ceremony they didn't do often, they usually did for chiefs, mm-hmm. and they were going to call the dolphins to feed, so they could feed him some dolphin fat. And he describes sitting on the beach while these people sang and called the dolphins and watching dolphins come and beach themselves in front of him to be killed.
Yes. The microphone cannot convey the utter shock and jaw droppingness going on in my face.
Yeah. I used to read that book as a kid. If I read it now, I would probably find it highly offensive in places. But what I got as a kid was that he did feel a basic respect for them. Mm-hmm. I mean, the ways in which he told the story might now be a little bit, beyond the pale. But mm-hmm. he found some stuff he hadn't expected to find.
Yeah.
I love the way they teased him about being too skinny. Mm-hmm. And they're like, no, you're a chief among your people. He wasn't. He was a bureaucrat, right?
Right, yeah.
They were willing to accord him chief status. A chief needs, when he sits, the rolls of fat need to start at his chest and just sort of flow down.
We're talking physical presence.
Yes, gravitas. And you don't have it, and we're going to fix it.
Oh, we should probably wrap it up. We've been going for a bit more than an hour.
Yes.
But this has been fabulous. This
yes.
has been
fabulous.
And you've got so many stories coming out now that I got to read. It's great.
I know. But officially, let's go through what you guys have coming out soon, like in terms of publications and stuff. Nalo?
I have a short story in After, which is a dystopian young adult anthology by Ellen Datlow and Terry Windling. And in April, my first young adult novel, which is called The Chaos, is coming out. I'm actually going to be reading from it in an hour.
Excellent.
Yeah.
And Karen?
In 2013, I'm going to have my first science fiction novel, The Best of All Possible Worlds. But Redemption at Indigo is also going to be published in the UK and Commonwealth in the next March of next year.
Nice.
By Joe Fletcher Books,
nice.
Who we're also doing for UK Commonwealth Best of All Possible Worlds. And the US Del Rey is publishing The Best of All Possible Worlds.
Very nice. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you guys both so much for telling us stories.
Very rambly, but I had fun.
I had tons of fun. I learned a lot. I got to sit down with you and
compare.
Give me a little reference list, please.
Compare Hartman stories, man.
Yeah.
Yes,
that's my favorite part of doing these podcasts. I learned so much.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.